Our next guest on the program has been working for decades in the nonprofit sector in the Los Angeles area. She's formerly an adjunct professor in the community college systems, has a graduate degree in organizational development from Northern Arizona University, and is the author of a very powerful new book entitled An Unintentional Accomplice, A Personal Perspective on White Responsibility. We're pleased to welcome Carolyn L. Baker to the show. Carolyn, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Richard. Thank you for having me on the show.
This is a very compelling book and a story that, a lot of us can relate to. And it begins with, the way we all, many of us, grew up anyway. For you, it was in Lakewood, California, the place euphemistically called at the time Tomorrow's City Today.
Right. Yes, and it was really a grand experiment in the first of these sort of tract homes, suburban development, and it was right after World War II, and the GI Bill helped all the veterans have a first mortgage and a first home, and I grew up on a street just full of kids, and it was a completely segregated, all-white experience.
And eventually your family would move to Orange County, and it was sort of that idyllic Southern California experience, but an idyllic white Southern California experience.
Yes, and this was very common back in those days, that the communities were separated, really social engineering, you could say, by race, and also even the freeways and the flood control systems. They seemed to separate the neighborhoods geographically and by race.
I was very interested to read about your high school experience because it sounded somewhat similar to mine, that we called it model schools, but the idea was to give a little more freedom to students. And sometimes that works out, sometimes not so much. But as you pointed out, this idea of focusing on self-actualization also enables you to tune out other people's reality.
Yes, I think that's a really important point. And that idea of just taking care of myself or just focusing really on my experience. I really grew up in a very insular, isolated bubble where I had really no interaction with people of other races, ethnicities, socioeconomic groups, or disabilities. It was a very homogeneous experience.
You became a young mother and a wife. You got involved with a religious group known as Jesus People, and then also were a victim of domestic abuse. What did you learn about yourself from those experiences?
Well, I think it's all part of everyone's journey. You know, we have our share of experiences that are very good teachers for us. I think I really began to just question some of the things that I automatically adopted. And I think during those years, I was born in 53, so coming of age in the late 60s, there was a great influence then of self-actualization, as you say, but then also the influence of just simply trying to find room or trying to find an understanding of my place in the world. So I think all of those chapters are reflective of that, but it's also reflective of just how naive I was or how insular my experience was to other people's reality in addition to my own.
We're talking with Carolyn Baker here on Downtown, and you talk about the fact that your upbringing had instilled in you the idea of being of service to your community, but no sense of a shared humanity with people of color.
Yes, you know, when I was 8 years old, my military father passed away, and my mother had a college degree, and she was a social worker. And I would go with her, and she was a very strong example of being a helper. But along with that, there was an example of the white savior and the black victim, so to speak. You know, we would go to the projects that were all people of color and low income, and she would be their helper. And so I met quite naturally to be seeing that as the right model. And then I got into nonprofits myself, had a 30-year career in nonprofits. And I think it's important to see that I think it was Martin Luther King who made a very important statement about that type of philanthropy. And it was something, I'm paraphrasing, that philanthropy is commendable, but it must not cause the philanthropist to overlook what are the circumstances, the economic injustice that's making this philanthropy or this helping necessary?
One of the things that helped to change your perspective was Hurricane Katrina. Can you talk about how that impacted you?
I think that just laid bare the really dramatic socioeconomic disparities in the country and how it was the people of low income that really suffered. And the lack of, you might say, even the difference of us as a group, it seemed like, oh, that's a natural disaster, so to speak. I think what Hurricane Katrina did is similar to what COVID-19 is doing, is it lays bare the disparities in healthcare that have been in existence for a very long time. You know, when we look at COVID-19 as a similar example, that we're really measuring the safety net that isn't working for all Americans. And I think that's an important starting place, is to call that out, to confront that and name that, and that these disparities were in place for a very long time before either of those two crises.
I thought it was very interesting. You write about not really being aware of the Emmett Till case until you were much older. And that's not unusual, because that's not the kind of thing that we would have been taught about in public schools in the 50s and 60s.
Yes, it's really a different part of any history of America that I knew. And that's why it was such a shock when I was 16, in the early 60s, watching Eyes on the Prize during Black History Month, and the story of Emmett Till and the photograph came on, and I was so shocked at the brutality of that racist, that lynching of that 14-year-old boy. I was equally shocked, but I had never heard about it, that I knew nothing of this, and I think that speaks to the reality for many people like myself, and that really I call myself out chapter by chapter in the book, that I just was so unaware of other people's lived experience in America and the full story of American history. So that really did launch me to rewind in a way and look at every decade of my own life, how it is that I got to be 62 years old and had never heard about the brutal murder of Nixon.
In your chapter, The Illusion of Separateness, you talk about the concept of Schadenfreude, taking pleasure in someone else's pain or discomfort, and it seems like more and more we're living in this zero-sum world where I can only win if you lose.
Yes, and that's, it may be that the question that I raise in the book is, I don't know if that's human wiring or if that's something that comes from a scarcity model. I don't have that answer, so to speak, but I think it's important that when we hear the phrase, we're all in this together, some people take objection to that and say, no, we're really not all in this together. Some people have been to work much, much harder to accomplish the same thing. And that's where the concept of empathy, so when we look at the social, economic, and healthcare disparities, is the feeling of, this is now starting to impact me. For example, COVID-19 means that we're all at risk right now. And maybe even if we couldn't muster the empathy, now we have to care just from a sense of survival, that we really all do have to, we're all going to be better off if we're all better off.
And when you talk about COVID-19, even within that and our experience right now, there are people who complain about what others are getting. You hear people talk, well, you can make more on unemployment than you can by going back to work. And there's this idea that many people have achieved their status in life solely through hard work. But as you point out, looking back at your own family's experience, that in the post-war period, there were a lot of families who were set up by what is in effect and was in effect white welfare.
Yes, and we were all too happy during those days to support it through taxes. We liked the idea of this public benefit. It wasn't until I was much older that I learned that people of color were largely denied those same benefits, like a GI loan, an FHA mortgage, which, as you said, in truth, that was life-changing white welfare. And I think then in the 60s, President Johnson had envisioned the Great Society and put in place a lot of community-based anti-poverty programs. But then the Vietnam War happened and all of the resources were diverted to support that military effort. So 50 years from Lyndon Johnson to today, that social safety net has been whittled away to the point now where it's seen as racial, that a group of undeserving others will be taking advantage of this benefit. So public health, public transportation, public anything has become racialized, and there isn't that feeling of the positiveness to having a safety net that's working for everybody.
So for us to help repair the differences here and build a better society is the first step for white Americans to be more aware of our background and potential biases in the way we view the world?
Well, I think that awareness is a very good start. And in other ways, we need to start naming things and confronting things. So, for example, if I look up, and I love words, I'm a writer, so I looked up the word racist because in my heart and mind, I wouldn't use that word to describe myself. But when I look at the definition at Merriam-Webster, here, I'll read it for you. Racist is a belief that race is the primary determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of one particular race. So what I love about this definition is that it's evenly applied to everybody, any race, anyone who expresses a racist idea or supports a racist policy. So it isn't about who a person is, it's about what is that person doing. So, for example, in my own heart and mind, I can say, oh, Carolyn, that's a racist thought. It doesn't mean I'm a racist, but it means that's a racist thought. So it creates an opportunity for a clear measurement. An action, an idea, a policy is either racist or it isn't. But the sponsoring thought is that there's nothing wrong with any particular racial group. And I think in my book, I just call myself out, and my own ways that I consumed racist ideas my whole life, really without even being aware of it. And that's why the title of the book is An Unintentional Accomplice.
It is a very thought-provoking read, An Unintentional Accomplice, A Personal Perspective on White Responsibility. Carolyn Baker, the author. Carolyn, thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon. Very good to talk with you.
Thank you for your time, too. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.